everyone. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis. It's a gorgeous Tuesday in Atlanta. Man, is that spring weather starting to happen. I was in the Beltline on Saturday. OMG, so fucking packed. A little too packed for my taste for the run I was going on. If you were strolling, it would have been nice. But Clayton and I did a nice long run. I am training for the Publix Marathon, if I haven't mentioned. If you're training for the Publix Marathon, or half, whatever, hey, give me a shout. Drop me a note here in the podcast. People are often shy, and they're not sure I mean it, but those of you that have been following me for a while on my previous program, the Obstacle Racing Media Podcast, you know that I always say hello back and perhaps even read your note on the show if you say okay. So if you're a fan of the show, you can either leave a review on iTunes, which I appreciate, or drop me a note. MattBDavis@iCloud.com. That's MattBDavis@iCloud.com. The Atlanta Podcast Facebook page is great as well. Instagram is getting the most love right now. So if you drop me a DM, if you slide into the DM on IG, probably the fastest way to get a response. Where was I? Atlanta, the Beltline, super crowded. The weather was super nice. On today's program, Mishka Shubali. Now, other than having a really, really cool name, Mishka wrote a book that I read many years ago, an ebook, if you will, and we actually get into the story, so I wanted to say too much about that, other than it was one of those super cool things where a friend said, do you, I have a friend you should talk to, and then he started describing the ebooks that he wrote, and I was like, I'd read one of those, I had no idea he lived here. And I went to his house, which is fun. Starting to do more and more of these on location rather than just coming to the Beltline, even though it's gorgeous here and it's super convenient to have them come to me where I'm already working. Having more and more fun doing these on location. So this was at his house with a nice treat at the end of a song that I really enjoyed and that you'll be singing in your head too. Also thought I'd give a shout out to podcasts that I'm enjoying. I know many of you have said to me in life or just, you know, as we talked to each other, how did you hear about this podcast? Oh, my friend referred me, or they mentioned it. Like Gimlet Media has some shows and they mention it at the end, by the way, check out this other show. So here's people that I really dig what they're up to and that I'm supporting. Number one, my friend Cole Lindberg in Kansas City. Cole and I have a long history. I'll tell it another time, but he does something called the Kansas City Podcast. And if you're like me, if you don't live in Kansas City, why would you be interested? Because he has these great, tight conversations with people in that city. And it's kind of a similar vibe to this show in its local folks and how they tick and what it means to the city. But I'm telling you, I'm interested in it. I like Cole. I started listening to it. And do I listen to all of them? No. But I definitely support him and what he's up to. And go check out that show. Also, Andrew Deitch at the Andrew Deitch Podcast. He also is an Atlanta-based podcaster who has given this show a lot of love. I want to give him a lot of love right now. My main man, Ray, a.k.a. Squishy Puss. You heard his episode. You found that he's a fascinating guy. If you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it. And then go check out his show, which is the Hellions Podcast. Go to Squishy Puss, either on Facebook or his website, and it'll get you a link. He does video, he does podcast, he's a creative MF-er and a guy I like a lot. I think that's it for now. Let's get into today's show. I told you I'm going to give you two a week, right? And we've been doing that. And I told you every Tuesday is the first one, and we've been doing that. So awesome. First one of the week, Mishka Shubali and I, live from his living room, away we go.
Test 1 2 1 2.
I like working with professionals who I don't have to tell where to hold the mic. So yeah. We're already off to a fucking awesome start.
I do a lot of podcasts where they have the mic mounted, and then you have to adapt your body to a position that you'll hold for the next 90 minutes while you know it's like being interrogated.
Right, but here's the thing: I want to get one of those because some people fiddle with the mic a lot, or they start fiddling with the cord.
Yeah.
And you tell them to stop and they do it anyway because it's just a nervous habit. So like I'm in a co-working space, so I just use these conference rooms, but I like to ideally get like the dope setup where it's at least up here, like radio station style. And then you can,
if you have the like adjustable accordion hinge, you know, those are good. I've definitely done some with the straight stand,
right?
Where then you're just sort of like, I was like, oh, this must be what it was like in Abu Ghraib, you know, we're just going to ask you personal questions about your private life, right, while you're maintaining this like super uncomfortable position.
All right. Well, I'll look at this thing because I'm constantly paranoid that I'm running out of battery or space or whatever. It's kind of my little nervous tick, but I'm going to start with reading your first book. Does that sound like a good place to start?
Let's so jump in called? There. My first Kindle single was Shipwrecked. I think the one you read was The Long Run.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is great. So, cause it gets a little bit of my story in there. So I did that thing where I started running in 2011 and then ran Bored to Run and then was like, this is amazing. Yep. I'm going to go to fucking Mexico. I'm going to do ultras. And you know, that was when I got my first Kindle and, you know, flipping through a couple things. I'm like, well, this looks cool. This looks short. And I read it and I'm like, that was pretty cool. I liked it. And then I probably read one more Kindle book and I never bought a Kindle. I never read another Kindle again.
Yep.
So that's kind of how that went. And then, our mutual friend who works in my co-working space, whose name is
Patrick.
I'm very
Patrick
sorry.
Patrick Hill. Yeah. He and I did 18 miles this weekend.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. He killed me.
Dude. Patrick, I don't know you ran that much. I know you're listening to this. We've talked about going on a run. So now we really have to go for a run. And don't take it personally that I forgot your name because I clearly know who you are.
Well, I'm just a wicked ADD person. Warning too. Patrick is a really good runner. He's really focused. He's on point.
He's not the let's go for a long run and shoot the shit guy.
No. I mean, we definitely like, you know, we shoot the shit like, well, but we'll talk, you know, for 3 hours or whatever, but he's focused. I mean, I love running with him.
Give me the ballpark time that you did your 18 in.
It ended up being like a 9:17 or, you know, 9:17, 24 seconds, something like that. We were trying to do a 9:30 pace for 18 miles.
So is that, what is that? 2:45?
So I can't do math. I can run it.
But I thought you'd know the end more than you know the pace. I thought, yeah, it took us about 3 hours. I thought you'd know that.
I take pride in not tracking my runs anymore. Because there was a point where I looked at my GPS, at my phone, at my wristwatch, at like all this crap, and I was like, this is not why I started doing this.
I have yet to reach that level of enlightenment.
it's a battle sometimes. I mean, there's definitely and some people, their happiness is tracking all that stuff. So if that's what makes you happy, then run to it, you know. But for me, I was like, you know, I'm 40. I started doing this when I was whatever, 32, 33. I'm not going to break any world records. I'm not going to go to the Olympics.
I don't even know my pace and I don't care. I just want to know mileage, time, elevation so that I can look back on it for whatever reason. And then at the end of the week and the end of the year, it's all there. So I like have, once I figured out that you could, I started with Runkeeper before I had a nice watch.
Uh-huh.
And then I got my first Garmin a couple years ago. And then I realized you could sync them together. So I kind of have literally every run track since winter of 2011. And I'm pretty jazzed about that.
Oh my God.
So like just 2 days ago, I ran at my buddy Clayton's house, paused it when I went in to see if he was going to come run with me. He didn't, forgot to unpause it. You know how mad I get that I didn't get credit for those 2 miles that I ran back home?
I know. Because I, you know, that's how I used to be. But you ran those miles. You did run them. You know, that there's not metrics for it. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And the other thing is, like, to what end are we tracking our miles?
That's what I'm saying. I don't know. Sometimes I just like to look at it. Like I'll flip through randomly. Sometimes it matters because it shows you, you know, you've done this same run 20 times and here's what you've done over the thing. Mm. Sometimes it's the same race 2 years later and I can look and see how it was. But a lot of times it's just like, oh, cool. That's what I did that day.
And that's the thing, man. It's like if it makes you happy, then then go for it. But like, and I do think, I mean, particularly for me, like there are a lot of times where I'll get bummed out or think like, shit, I'm not making any progress, not just as a runner, but as a human being. And then I think, well, what was I doing a year ago? What was I doing 2 years ago? What was I doing 5 years ago? And that's always helpful to me because then I can say, oh man, I feel like I haven't made any progress, but when I look back a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, I've done a lot of shit, you know?
I'm now having the inverse effect though, because I started in 2011, 2014, best shape of my life. And now I've let myself go and not mixed much up. And so it's like, please don't tell me my best days are behind me, which I know is not true.
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 40, about to be 46.
Okay. Maybe after the pod, I'll try and give you some older dude secrets to.
Can I say for the record, if someone were to guess who is older, who do you think they would pick? Looking at
both of us? Oh, me, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm grizzled and road worn,
right? And I've got the beard today, which makes me look slightly older. But I was gonna say all the top runners and all the like experienced runners you ever read all say that, get rid of the watch, just run in the woods, it'll be amazing. And like I said, I'm just not there yet.
Yeah. You'll get there.
Or not.
Or you won't, and either way it's fine.
Right. Okay, so Patrick's like, you should meet my friend. He wrote this book. And he wrote a bunch of books on Kindle, and the first one was called The Long Run. I was like, wait a minute, I read that fucking thing. So I immediately wanted to talk to you. So now we have to get to
the backstory.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I was a shithead drunk that is the precise medical term for it.
Right.
I was a drunkard. For 17 years. I mean, I started young, went hard for a long time. I quit when I was 32 without AA or rehab and just white knuckling it in my apartment. And then I was like, well, now what do I do with myself?
Right.
And then, I was working at a bar. And a friend of mine who was working security that night got sucker punched and he got knocked out. And dealing with all that bullshit, I ended up leaving my bike there. And then the next day I woke up and I was just like, man, fuck that guy for punching my friend. Like, I need to get my bike back. And I walked outside and I was like, I'm not going to wait for the bus.
And which part of the world was this?
I was in Brooklyn and my bike was in Manhattan.
Okay.
And I just started running and I ran all the way into the city to get my bike. And I thought I was going to die. I still remember how painful that run was. But then I got my bike and I was like, oh my, holy shit. I ran the whole way and it was like 4.5 miles.
Right.
And I was like,
but that may as well be like 20 when you're starting out.
Exactly. And you know, And that's one of the things about tracking mileage. That 4.5 miles was harder than anything else I've ever done. You know, I mean, that was brutally hard. It was, and that's probably the run that I'm the proudest of. You know, that was the most integral because that was my sort of gateway to a new life. And then I just, whenever, and, you know, and I was still in very early sobriety and had no idea how to deal with myself or negotiate the world. And then whenever I was, depressed or angry or anxious or just didn't know how to deal with my feelings, I ran. And that was a lot of miles. And, So I ended up getting into ultra running, and you know, I think the longest distance I've run is I did 100K once, so whatever, 62 miles. I've done back-to-back marathons and stuff like that. In the ultra running world, I am definitely small beans. But I think what's important about my story is I found a way to help myself. I found a way to transform my life, to dig myself out of the hole that I was in, and running was the tool that I used to do it.
And did you ever get into 12-step?
No, I have a tricky relationship with AA, but tons of my friends, you know, have been going to AA for years and, you know, sing the praises of the program. So I sort of, my relationship with AA is the inverse of my relationship with Radiohead, where with AA, I definitely support the disciples, the fans, the people who are really into AA. I totally support them, but I'm not into the thing. And with Radiohead, I'm like, the band is okay. It's just the fans are the fucking worst.
I think that's a fantastic analogy.
Thank you.
So yeah, I got sober way before I started running. But you know, I did what most people do, which is like smoke a lot, right? Like once I gave up alcohol, I had quit smoking for a long time. I started smoking again, and it wasn't until I started having kids that I stopped. But even then, running was this just thing that people did. Like I didn't see anything positive out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, if you're not a runner and you see somebody laboring on the side of the, you know, on the side of the road, like particularly in the cold or in the dark, or if it's, you know, if it's a bigger person, you know, like, why the fuck are you doing that? You know, I mean, it just looks miserable. And now, oh man, I mean, every once in a while I'll be out running and I'll see somebody who's like 270, clearly down from 320.
Right.
Not fucking that inspires me like nothing else. You know how hard it is to run when you're that heavy?
Yeah.
That takes, you know, that inspires me so much more than the elite runners, the marathon runners, the sprinters, the like super hardcore long distance people. You know, when I see somebody out there struggling to do 2 miles
right.
to change themselves, I'm just like, I'm with you, man. I'll run with you every day. I'll do anything that I can right. to support you.
So this time last year, it was really, really cold. And like maybe this cold or colder first thing in the morning. And when I went for morning runs, people would like beep and like wave at me because they were like, yeah, man, good on you. And that's not something that normally happens.
Yeah. Every once in a while, I remember I was in Mexico with my uncle and I was running. And nobody really does that in Mexico unless they have to.
Right.
And I ran to... 13 or 14 miles out, and there was a little girl on the side of the road selling the green coconuts, and I, you know, was sort of, and she just like looked at me like, you know, are you okay? Who's chasing you? And and you know, I was able to communicate to her, you know, both that I wanted a coconut and where I'd come from, and the look of sort of shock and dismay on her face. She was just like, what are you doing?
Right.
You know? But yeah, it's, I love, you know, every once in a while you'll see another runner and you sort of like get the nod from them.
Right.
Or, you know, when I was running in New York initially, it would be cab drivers who would see me and they would beep at me like, let me give you a ride home, buddy.
Right.
And I was like, oh, fuck you, man.
Right. Well, and the other thing is like people... like the perspective of the average person. So my buddy Clayton, he's like my ride or die bro. We run together all the time, and we had run, and it was like, it was one of those runs where we didn't know where we were going, which is always the best for me because that's the way I'm going to get a long run. If I run anywhere near my house, it's going to be, I'm going to quit. Even if I say, well, I could probably, you know, do kind of an 8 or something. So we take off and it's like, okay, I brought my debit card, here's a CVS, and we go in and they're like, how far are you running today? I'm like, well, we've done 6 so far. They're like, no, you haven't. I'm like, yeah, we're gonna do a couple more, but they're like, they couldn't believe like 6 miles was like 1,000 to them. This is why, you know, when you tell people about ultra marathons, I have to lie because you can't even have the conversation, right? You go, what are you running? Well, I'm doing 50K. How many miles is that? 32. No, you're not. You're not running 32 miles in a row.
Yeah. It's I was thinking about that last night as I was falling asleep, you know, is that it's like we're in the upside down now. Yeah. You know, you think back, you know, a couple thousand years ago, which is a short period of time, you know, in the sort of scale of the Earth or the galaxy or the universe, and the, you know, human beings, you know, sort of reason to be here, reason to live was to get as much food as possible, expend as little effort as possible, and procreate. And now the biggest problems that we're facing is that we eat too much, we don't exercise enough, and there's too fucking many of us. And it's, I was like, and kept me up, man. I couldn't deal with it. But yeah, I mean, running, dude, running 6 miles is, don't get me wrong, I ran 3 miles yesterday and it was tough because I didn't want to run. But running 6 miles should not be incredible. It sucks that we live in a time, in a country, in a world where to the average person that blows their mind.
Right.
You know? Everybody should be doing that.
All right, but let's back up a little bit more. So you were doing what for a living when you had your big running epiphany?
Oh, dude, I was doing nothing. I was, when I got sober, I was, I worked like a night or sometimes two nights a week at a bar, you know, doing security, sort of like when the regular guy couldn't
were
do
you,
it.
Were you like bigger, like more like?
No,
because you're tall, but not necessarily like
I've
bouncer big.
Yeah, I've never been bouncer big. I know how to fight, and I also have the sort of deep voice and the authoritative tone that a lot of times.
Are you a Roadhouse fan?
Oh God, yes, of course. Yeah, love Patrick Swayze in that. Mostly what I was doing is like I had a car in New York, so I would like pick up shit off the free section of Craigslist and then like sell it in the like furniture section or whatever. I was barely scraping by, just barely scraping by. I'd gotten to a point where like I'd been fired from just about every bar gig I had and hadn't had a real job in a long time and was not just unemployed, but unemployable.
Right. Getting fired for what? Not showing up?
No. I would show up. I would just be like so fucked up. I was unable to work.
Right.
And also, I'm a terrible employee.
Me too, by the way. That's why I do.
Yeah.
That's why I work for myself.
You know, I had to, you know, because I have a shitty attitude when somebody else is, you know. God, when I was working with this construction company, my boss would be like, oh, I took these really funny pictures of my cat. I want you to get them off my phone, print them up, and then fax them to my buddy.
No, he did not.
Shit like that. And I was like, man, I have dreams for my life, and this is not part of it. You know, I have shit that I want to do, you know? And so, yeah, I was always a terrible employee. And I bet I would be worse now. But then after I got sober, my friend Mike Stewart in New York, they were looking for a manager at a beauty bar. And he and I had been friends for a long time. And he I think he knew he was taking a chance on me. But he knew I was sober and he knew that, like, I was committed to it. And, so he got me a job, you know, working there a couple days a week. And then... But that was still just sort of subsistence, you know? Right. And then when I started publishing through Amazon, after working at Beauty Bar for, I don't know, a year and a half, I went up to Mike and I was like, yo, man, I quit. And he was like, what? Why are you quitting? And I was like, dude, look at this check.
All right, so let's talk about that. So first of all, the Craigslist hustle is still a viable business, by the way.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. I have a friend who was just kind of randomly picking stuff to buy. You know, he bought a jukebox, he bought an ATM, like whatever, and then he honed in on stereo shit, and now he's like the fucking king of stereos in Denver. Like, they're making bank.
And I love those stories.
No, me too, dude.
It shows like what a sort of wasteful world we live in and how if you use your brain, you can get ahead.
Right. So what has one go, hey, wait a minute, I can self-publish on Amazon and see what happens? Like, how does that even happen?
A lot of people sort of give me credit for being like an innovator, and that's totally not true.
Right.
Good old
dumb luck.
Yes. What happened was, I had a relationship with David Blum, who was the editor at Amazon. Previously he had been my editor at New York Press, where I was writing about like drugs and sleeping in construction sites and like the trouble I used to
get. So you'd already been writing.
I'd been writing a little bit, but you know, it was sort of like $50 here and $100 there, that kind of thing. But Blum recognized that I could write and that I had a story to tell. And he was like, Amazon's, you know, starting this new platform, you know, Kindle Singles. And you should really write for it. You know, you could make a ton of money. And I was like, bullshit, dude. Like, I was like, number one, it'll never work. Number two, if it works, it'll, you know, it won't work for me, you know. And number three, like, I'm sober now. Like, I don't have any stories. And he was like, you don't have one story left. And I was like, well, there is that one time I got shipwrecked. And he was like, Mishka, you asshole, that's the story. You know, so that was the first story that I published with Amazon. It was an account of getting shipwrecked in 2001. It went to number one, stayed there, hung out there for a while. And
so wait a minute. You put this thing on Amazon.
Yeah.
Did he list you as like a new feature, or did it give you some sort of kickstart?
Yeah, it was the program is called Kindle Singles. And I think they send out one email. You know, they hooked me up with a designer who, like, you know, made the cover.
Right.
And then I think they send one email. And believe me, every single person in my, like, in my Gmail account who I'd ever emailed ever, every single one of those people got a fucking email where I was like, hey, you know, we met once when I had a flat tire.
Right.
Here's, you know, and I was just... you know, I sort of like ruthlessly hounded people to buy it, to review it. And that, but you know, I mean, how many people do I know realistically? 1,000 people, you know, 1,500. That got it rolling enough that, you know, that then thousands and thousands and thousands of people bought it. And
what did it sell for?
It sold for $1.99. And the, it was a 70-30 split. So my first check from them was like, $7,000, which at that point was a fortune beyond my all of, three zeros. Are you kidding?
Right.
You
know, right. I can pay bills and then actually have some left over.
Yeah. And also the way the royalties were set up, I knew that the next month I would be getting another check, you know, another bigger check. So I was like, I just gambled and I was like, fuck it, man. I've got to, this is it. This is my chance. Finally, now I'm getting it. You know, I'm getting a chance to make it as a writer, to work as a writer. So I quit my job and, you know, started hustling to write the next story. The next story was The Long Run. And there's ugly bits in that story. And it was a lot for me to reveal that much, to go that deep. And, when I published it, I was like, this is it. With this story, I'm going to destroy the writing career that I've like just started to make. And so it went up. And then the next day I was running a Cape Cod marathon and I woke up at like 4 a.m. and there'd been this like huge fucked up snowstorm, like a foot and a half of snow. And I was like, you know, the power had gone out and I was like, Christ, this is going to be a miserable day. I turned on my phone and The Long Run had gone to number one over Dean Koontz and Stephen King.
Wow.
And I ran the fastest marathon of my life.
Because you were so fucking jacked up.
Yeah. I was just like, ah, you know, like killing it, you know?
So the 70-30, Amazon gets 70 or you get 70?
I got 70.
I bet they don't do that deal anymore.
You are correct.
Why the fuck are we giving this guy the lion's share? You've had to have read the Anything Store, right?
No, I haven't.
Or the Everything Store, sorry.
I have a weird conflicted relationship with Amazon,
which is why you should read this book.
Yeah. I know that they're sort of like a huge evil multinational corporation with, you know, far more power and wealth than anyone should accrue. And also Jeff Bezos has been incredibly nice to me. And
do you get to meet the man?
I've never met him. We've exchanged emails a couple of times. Last year I was a clue on Jeopardy.
Really? And, yeah. Dude, come on. If that's not making it.
It's funny because I was like, I don't really watch TV and I didn't know about it. And I was just sort of sitting here and my phone buzzed and somebody was like, and, you know, it was a girl I hadn't spoken to in a year. And she was like, I was just on the treadmill at the gym and you were on TV. You're on Jeopardy. And I was like, bullshit. And then my phone started freaking out and I was like, okay, no, this is real. And it's funny because I hadn't done anything new to achieve that. I mean, right. You know, it's from like old shit. But when that happened, everybody started treating me differently. Like,
yeah.
Like, dude, I didn't do anything. I didn't make any money.
So, you know, so what was the answer and what was the question?
I think the question was, this CEO wrote the foreword to Mishka Shabali's, collection, The Long Run, and other Kindle singles. You know, and the answer was, who is Jeff Bezos?
Right.
Because after my sixth number one Kindle single, I was out on a run, and I was out on a run, and then I came back, and then the last one had like just gone to number one, and I was like, fuck it, man, I got to do this. And I emailed him, and I was like, hey, you may not know who I am, but you've totally, transformed my life. My last Kindle single just went to number one. You know, we're talking about doing a collection. Would you be interested in writing the foreword? And I just sent it off, and I was like, this is another email that I will never get a response. You know, right. One of the millions.
Was it just jeff@amazon.com?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. He wrote back in like half an hour. He was like, hey, what's up? Big fan. I'd love to. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, this guy is a rocket ship. You know,
no, that's pretty dope, dude.
And dude, the foreword that he wrote is phenomenal. I mean, it's amazing. It's just incredibly cool. Yeah, it's a weird life, dude. It's, fortunately, hey, glad I didn't die. Glad I didn't die. Cause there was sort of all sorts of weird adventures. I just, I had never even thought of, that could happen.
So how is the singles business these days?
It's dropped off a lot. The market has changed. Blum has moved over to Audible. I basically published three books worth of memoir in about 5 years.
It's a lot.
And I'm kind of out of shit right now. I have... I'll be 9 years sober in May.
Is that me or you?
And that's you.
I'm going to put myself on airplane real quick.
And I'll be 9 years sober in May. I have this, this awesome little, underground bunker here in Atlanta. Working my ass off, touring as a musician. And, life's pretty good. I love David Sedaris, and his recent writing has been like, what shall I do with my guest house? And I was like, that's not terribly compelling, dude. I don't really feel for you.
Right.
So I've been focusing way more on the music aspect of my career. I have a couple other like collaborative projects I'm working on. I will be writing some new stuff this summer. The Long Run, at this point, it's been translated into 5 or 6 different languages. It's sold maybe 100,000 copies. It's in the New York Public Library.
So there is a real version of it.
No, it's the digital version is in the New York Public Library.
Well, it's interesting because I have written a book. I'm in this world called obstacle racing. I don't know.
Yeah. I know that world. But sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. Well, I was going to ask if he had mentioned that.
Yeah. Patrick mentioned that, that you do that stuff. I didn't know if you're an aficionado, if you do it a lot, or if you host races or put races on or what you're, but tell me what's.
Sure. So I started running and fell in love with it, but then also fell in love with this OCR thing. And I started a podcast in 2012 because there wasn't one about obstacle racing. And again, like now I look like I had a really great idea ahead of the curve, but it honestly was like, this seems like fun to me.
Uh-huh.
And then it's one of those things that it grew to become a business, right? So now it's Obstacle Racing Media, it's a website, it's social media, blah, blah, blah.
That's great.
Yeah. But when I wrote a book, I didn't make any money. I still don't make any money other than what I got up front, which I'm proud of what I got up front. And when other people ask about it, I go, well, look, it's a brand builder. It's a nice thing on the resume. You don't go into it and make money unless you're Dean Koontz. But you figured out how to actually make money, which is why it's so impressive, because most people do have a book because they're, or it's the back of the room thing, right? They go on speaking tours, they buy the book for $9, they sell it for $20, right? And that's how they make some money.
Yeah, yeah.
But you, well, but you don't even have to deal with the fuck traveling with books.
Well, I do both worlds, you know. So I published 6 Kindle singles, and you know, let me hit this again hard. That was dumb luck. That was not me being an innovator. That was not, you know what I mean?
And I know us addicts and alcoholics have a tough time with compliments, and and you have a skill, and you wrote compelling material that people wanted to read.
Okay. All right. I also, from my success publishing digitally, I got a traditional book deal, and wrote a hardcover book, published that, got money up front, haven't made a dime since. And now I do, you know, when I'm on the road, I have a suitcase full of hardcovers.
Okay.
That I take with me that I'll sell signed copies of. And that book didn't sell. And whenever I tell people, oh, that book didn't sell, everybody shrugs and says, oh, well, books don't sell.
Right.
You know, so it's weird, because it's like we, you know, I mean, there's the Kindle thing, where I've had a similar experience of like buying a Kindle and then buying a couple of books and then being like, this is an unsatisfying reading experience.
Right.
You know, I mean, I have a stack of books right here.
Right.
You know,
you got some good bathroom reading.
Yes.
Along with a couple of bikini tops. Do I need to ask who those belong to?
that's my girlfriend. The other day I was like sort of like wandering around late at night after working all day. And I was like, oh, there's a bikini there. Wait, there's another. How many bikinis does one woman need?
Right.
And I guess the answer is a bunch. I have like one pair of shorts. That's like my running shorts. That's my swimsuit. That's, you know.
Right. Well, that's how it's like to be a dude.
Yeah.
We don't need much. We're simple creatures.
But, excuse me. But yeah, so I was definitely super fortunate with the Kindle singles. And, the great thing about that is that, like, it's still up for sale on Amazon. So I still get new messages from people who are like, hey, I just discovered The Long Run, or just read this. You know, I really love your writing. So that, you know, that story is sort of still out there doing its work.
When did you release it?
It came out, Jesus, let's see. I got sober in 2000. It came out fall of 2011.
You know what? I should have done the research, because it doesn't take much to go on Amazon and see when I bought it.
Uh-huh.
Because it had to be not long after. I mean, I only bought two or three things. I bought that. Mark Cuban had a thing that was like 80 pages or something. I bought that.
Right.
I can't even think what else I bought. I think I did read Born to Run That Way. I might have read all of Born to Run That Way. I'm not sure. But it couldn't have been long after it came out. So I feel like you're out there doing your thing in the world, and somewhere, you know, random me is in fucking Atlanta, Georgia, reading your little book. I think that's super cool.
Yeah, it's been such a trip. I mean, I've gotten messages from India, from Russia, from Poland, you know, I mean, just like around the world. It's a trip for, you know, somebody like Patrick, you know, because Patrick used to babysit me when I was just like a total drunk, you know. I mean, Patrick Hill and Damon Hare, like two rock promoters from Atlanta, both used to babysit me at like South by Southwest, or like, you know, when my band was on tour and stuff like
so
that.
So we should talk about your, first of all, so why are you here? When did you come to Atlanta?
I moved here year ago, year and a half ago.
Okay, so you haven't been here that long.
I have not been here very long. No,
so
I
were you just sort of, when you tour as yourself with a band?
I tour solo as a singer-songwriter. People compare it to like Johnny Cash or Nick Cave, that kind of thing.
Right.
I just, you know, I left New York in 2015, because, you know, my building got sold and I had to leave, and it was like, and I got priced out. I moved there when I was 21. It was time to go. And then I didn't have a fixed place for 2 years. I was just like touring nonstop, and that was exhausting. And then I met a girl and fell in love and moved here.
And are you going to get married?
I'm not big on the whole marriage thing. I think it's a failed institution.
It is in many ways. I am in a successful one, but I find I'm in the, you know, I'm in the minority.
Yeah.
I've had two friends either get divorced, like just like as in like the recent months, another friend of mine who we would hang out with them as a couple all the time. And now it's going sideways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every once in a while, you know, I can think of a handful of marriages, you know, that I think like, oh yeah, that still works. Those two people still seem delighted to see each other. But for the most part, I think this is sort of sideways from our original conversation, but I think it's, you know, it was sort of born around, you know, compiling your assets and having children and raising children, you know, and that's what it's about.
Right.
I have no interest in ever having children.
Right.
So why get married? You know?
Yeah. I wouldn't, I mean, this is what I tell people, 'cause people ask me, so, you know, my wife's sober too, and that's kind of a big thing. So we speak a lot of the same language.
Deal.
Yeah. And it means that if she has some shit going on, she's not going to bring 100% of it to me. She's going to go to her people and figure some shit out. Right.
Uh-huh.
And I can do the same thing. Right?
Right.
So then we come together and have kind of a different conversation than just everything's fucking your fault. But here's what I say. It's a crapshoot. Yeah. And if you bet on the right horse, it's awesome. But if you don't, and that person, I mean, men or women, turns out to be fucking Looney Tunes, then, you know what I mean? Then
yeah.
It's a gamble. So I think I happen to pack the right horse.
Yeah. My girlfriend's sober too. She's sober. She's a writer. She's a runner, you know, and that really helps. But, you know, I mean, I've done this, you know, thing again and again when I go on tour of like just touring with strangers, you know, like a musician I've met once or a musician I've never met. And people are like, how do you do that? Why would you do that? You know, just a stranger, they could be crazy. You know what? People you know could be crazy,
right?
Your closest friends, you know, people, your inner circle, particularly when people get into a van, that's when they start fucking melting down,
right?
You know,
so is that the tour machine, that thing that I saw outside?
Yeah, man.
Got to get a picture of that for the, maybe we'll have you pose by that for the,
Yeah, I love that van. It's I had somebody actually do a tour poster that looks like Big Daddy Roth, and it's, you know, that that van with like, you know, flames coming out of it and all.
Right.
That
shit. Actually, while I'm thinking about it, I'm gonna set up a little camera and we'll just use it for like, you know, like a B-roll thing later, because I'm trying to promote in multiple ways. While I'm doing this, I can ask you, like, how are you on the social media and promoting yourself and whatnot? Because the book, it kind of lives there on Amazon. It kind of does its perpetual thing. But for your other works, do you, like, are you on social much?
Yeah, I mean, I embarrass myself with how much I'm on social media and how reliant I am upon it. I mean, it in some ways, you know, people... You know, it seems like sort of our second life or our second world sometimes. But then there are times where it seems to, where it seems like real life is our secondary life and social media is the real thing. But yeah, I'm at Mishka Shabali on Twitter. I'm at Mishka Shabali on Instagram. I'm the only Mishka Shabali on Facebook. I try not, you know, I think it's emotionally exhausting to have any sort of online connection with somebody who's always hawking their shit, always trying to close the deal. And, you know, so I focus mostly on, you know, dog pics and dick jokes. Because that's what life's about. You
I
know?
Think that's what, that is what life is about. Dog pics. And this looks kind of comfy now. This looks kind of cozy.
I know. It's like cozy. It's like my two gay dads.
My two gated bearded Jew dads. Are you a Jew?
No. Oh, but okay. People are always like, you know, are you a Jew? And I'm like, well, no, but I lived in New York for 17 years. So I'm Jew-ish.
And you're right. And you're in Russian background, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's like...
Yeah. No, my family are like staunch Roman Catholics.
Right.
So I did that 23andMe thing and I was like, I'm going to find out I'm a Jew.
And I'm
going to go and throw it in their faces and everybody's going to be heartbroken.
So you haven't done it yet?
No, I did it and I'm not Jewish. And I was like, I was so disappointed.
How much is that, by the way? 23andMe.
I think it was like $100.
Right.
But I mean, I did it, whatever, 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Right.
It would have been worth it had I found out that I was Jewish and to be able to go back and tell my family, like, aha,
I knew it.
I know, but oh well.
And so how far ahead for you, like, okay, I'm going to tour these months, but then I want to take this big break so I can write and stuff. Like, how does that?
I mean, you generally book yourself, you know, 3 or 4 months in advance, and it sucks because it's like, how am I going to feel 3 months from now? You have no idea, you know, and there, you know, I leave on tour again on Thursday, and I wish I wasn't, you know, I mean, I have such a conflicted relationship with it. Cause like I love it and I hate it and I feel compelled to do it. And I wish I didn't.
Compelled because of like money or just because you think you don't want to do anything else or?
Well, I mean, rock and roll is a young man's game. I'm the youngest now that I will ever be. You know,
it's that, like, is correct.
I got to get as much of this in as I can before I hit a point where I'm like, I just can't do it anymore. And every time I'm like, this is it, man. Like, I'm fucking done. I'm sick of the road food. I'm sick of the road. I'm sick of the people. I'm sick of the bullshit. I'm sick of the, you know, sick of the Red Roof Inn and the fucking, you know, the Sunoco gas station. Just, you know, that grind. Then I will have some show that, like, where it all comes together somehow, you know? And I'm like, God damn it. Now I can't quit. You know?
Right.
Because now, It sort of like puts new life into you. I'm doing a couple of shows this weekend with this band Heels, and they're a 2-piece guitar and drums. So their guitar player will play bass and they'll back me up and then I play bass with them.
Nice.
And there's a lot of sort of mutual admiration there. So we have a blast. It's our slogan, you know, for doing the shows together is, twice as much work for half as much money and 4 times as much fun. You know, it's definitely a blast, but it's, you know, trying to make a buck playing music is like, it's fucking hopeless, man. I mean, this is a line I cribbed from my buddy, Michael Dean Dameron, but you know, he said, I'm not a musician. I'm a long distance t-shirt salesman.
Right.
You know, cause that's the only way. Nobody buys music. Nobody buys CDs anymore.
So you sell the merch?
Yeah. Few people even go to live shows, you know, and the money you make from a live show after you pay for the, you know, the sound engineer and the door guy and like all that shit. It's nothing.
You know, well, I know that money. Record sales are down, but my impression is that young people still go to rock shows.
Not my shows. They go to, you know, the sort of Hot Topic emo band, you know.
Is Hot Topic even a thing anymore?
God, I don't even know.
I think we might be dating ourselves.
When's the last time I went to a mall?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know if they exist anymore.
Whenever I go to rock shows now, like, people are like, is that guy a cop or is he selling fake ecstasy? Like, you know, is that somebody's dad?
Right.
I don't give a shit. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's tricky, you know, balancing sort of like tour life and home life. And, but man, this is it. This is real life right now, you know, and I'm well aware that, it could end tomorrow. And this is what I want to do, you know? And so you just, at a certain point, you have to just say, I'm going to do everything and anything I can to live the life that I want to live, the life that's fulfilling for me, and fuck the consequences, you know, and you find a way to make it work, whether it's flipping, you know, stereo equipment you find on Craigslist or, you know, publishing your writing through a digital platform or being a cam girl or whatever the fuck it is to get out of that daily 9-to-5 grind, which is totally poisonous, and to do something that's actually meaningful to you. You know, I really think that, you know, work is the most poisonous thing out there, the most toxic substance I've encountered. I work damn hard, but I work for myself. I don't punch the clock, you know, and neither do you. So I guess we're on the same page with that.
Yeah. But see, I found out my thing is that, I'm an entrepreneur, but like that word meant something different like 20 years ago. And I didn't think it was me. I thought it was the kid who had the lawn mowing business already at 14. And then he moved up from there. Right. So I wanted to be a stand-up comic. That was my thing, right? So my first business completely started on accident. So I was in LA and I was doing, but here's a quick thing that you'll appreciate. I lived here. I started comedy in Boston and I was like, okay, I've been doing this a couple years. Now I'm going to make the big move. I'm going to go to LA. And when I go to LA, I'm going to get so drunk and fucking drugs and laid. I'm going to be in every Hollywood party, like just like I imagine the movies. And I hit bottom so fast, I got sober like 30 days later after getting to LA. So like,
that's amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
Like big joke, right? But then I ended up starting a business.
There's a ton of comics who go to LA with that same vision, and I wish they would all just bottom out after 30 days and get sober. And a lot of them are still grinding.
Right. But I've talked about this on here before, so I don't want to go too much in it, but I do look back on that, and it was for the wrong reasons. Right? Like, of course I wanted to, like there was no deeper purpose besides those things. Please like me, please laugh at me, you know, please fuck me, basically. Like those are the things. Yep. So the things you do to make it as a stand-up, even when I got sober, work hard at your craft, be nice to everybody, be nice to all the club owners, don't try to sleep with the waitresses. And I did everything wrong because I was just like, now, right? Even though I was sober from drugs and alcohol, I still have that addict mentality of fuck you, you can't tell me what to do, and I know best. And, you know, we talk about, one of the program things is like a worker among workers. And it's like, I'm never going to be that because I'm better than everybody, right?
Yeah.
So that doesn't really work. So here I am, you know, two or three businesses later, and, you know, this is my art and this is what I really want to do. And hopefully I can learn from those mistakes, because I did that touring life and it's what I thought I wanted, but there's no way I could do that now. Like I got kids and I don't stay up past 10 o'clock. You know what I mean? But I definitely live that life of, okay, I'm 2 days between the next gig. Do I get cigarettes or gas or food? Right?
Yep. Yeah. No, it's funny because I mean I tour with comics a lot. And,
right.
You know, I mean I've performed at comedy festivals and stuff like that. I mean I'm careful not to call myself a comic because I'm up there because of my songs. But I toured with Doug opening for Doug Stanhope.
Oh, he's the man.
Yeah. And I sort of got the nod from him. He said, you know, incredibly nice things about my music, and that's opened a ton of doors for me. And then I found that I was touring with a lot of comics, and then, you know, we'd play some nights and I would be like, man, I'm funnier than some of these guys.
Right.
You know, so then I started writing bits and writing jokes, and then, yeah, now my live act is, it's like half songs and half, you know, me talking trash.
Right.
But yeah, I mean it's hard sober. It's definitely hard to do sober, and also there's no way it would be impossible if I wasn't sober.
Right.
You know, I mean you have to have your wits about you. You have to have your sort of like mental and emotional strength. And I remember when I was on the road when I was drinking and stuff, like just calling my mother in tears.
Right.
And, you know, just being, you know, sort of like totally fucking broken down, or like seeing, you know, that cold slice of pizza that somebody had thrown in the trash, and I was like, well, if I eat that instead of buying food, then that's another $6 I can spend on alcohol.
Right.
You know, and just making those like stupid choices like that. But now, you know, sober, doing sort of like comedy nights at dive bars, performing with, you know, with comics, I found a thing where like I can come back from the road with a little bit of money. It's still incredibly rewarding. There's nothing better than seeing some comic you've never heard of, somebody you don't know at all, and, you know, in a room of like whatever 20 people with no expectation, and then they hit you with something that's so unexpected that you just bark with laughter,
right,
against your will,
right?
You know, where like an ugly laugh where you spray spit or snot, or that is an incredibly good feeling, and it's so rare, and it's hard to come by. But when it happens, when that magic happens on the road, it's like, it's just, you know, it's transformative. Oh, dude, fuck that. Don't worry about it.
I think we should have you do a couple numbers. Would you do that? Do you have an in-tune guitar, an acoustic or anything, or electric for that matter?
It'd take me 2 minutes to grab my acoustic. We can break and I can bust out a song if you want to hear one.
I think that'd be cool.
Right on. Let's do it.
You want to do it right now?
Why are we rapping? Are we done? Do you want to?
I don't know. I feel like
we should close on a song or something.
No, we should definitely close on a song. But I was just checking where we were on time. So this, I go all over the place. I'm not sure what podcast you've done in the past, but I don't do anything in advance and I just sort of like, let's fire this up and see how it goes.
No, that's the best way for it to happen. I mean, there's nothing worse than doing an interview. There have been interviews I've been asked to do where I'm like, yeah, I'll do an interview, and they send me 10 questions and I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. This is not an interview. You've sent me a worksheet. This is like Spanish homework. It makes me sound like a diva, but an interview is, it's an interaction between two people. That's what's important about it. It's, the sort of inquiry and probing intelligence. It's not a fucking boilerplate thing of like...
When people will write that to me, they'll say, do you want to send me any questions in advance? I always respond, what fun would that be?
Yeah. I have done podcasts where people are just sort of like, well, okay, explain yourself. Tell us who you are. And I'm like, oh, all right, you don't know a single thing. You saw my name in print somewhere and you fucking have no idea who I am or what I've done or like.
So once upon a time, everybody started a blog, and in 2017, 18, everybody has a podcast.
Yep.
And I am shockingly surprised at how bad some are. But it also gives me hope because I have friends who tell me, Matt, I listen to a lot of podcasts and a lot of them are garbage. So keep doing what you're doing because you're going in the right direction.
Yeah. It's hard when everybody is sort of doing the same thing that you're doing, but you actually believe in what you're doing.
Right. I
mean, there's a million fucking white boys with guitars out there.
Right.
People are like, oh, like Jack Johnson. I'm like, no, fuck no. I did a podcast once where, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he, his sort of opening gambit was, talking about how, sort of a lot of addicts, become runners, triathletes, sort of long distance folks. And he was like, so tell me about your experience with exercise addiction. And I was like,
I don't have an exercise addiction.
I'm not an exercise addict.
Right.
Like, really? And then I was like, I know that it exists. I know it's a thing. I'm not a psychologist. Right. Can't really, And so then we had this sort of awkward halting conversation about where he was trying to horseshoe me. And I was like, no, dude, I hate running. That is not my problem. I'm a sober alcoholic and that has, its ups and downs. But running is a tool like meditation or therapy that I use to, not to cure, but to heal my addict's brain. And it's a coping mechanism that I use to sort of negotiate my world sober. It's brought me only good things. And, I exercise the complete opposite way that I used to drink, where I would be like, I made it to 4 o'clock. I get to reward myself with a drink or a pill or whatever. And with running, I'm like, maybe I can do it tomorrow.
Right.
That's not addiction. I'm well versed in addiction and that is not addiction. I'm all about organic conversations and just sort of seeing where things go, what happens.
All right. Well, before we get to the songs, we'll wrap it up with my Atlanta quiz is kind of sort of what I'm calling it. Are you ready?
All right, hit me. I'm gonna just totally duff this one.
You can't because these are all opinion questions.
Okay.
So I need a better name for it. Let me know at the end if you can think of a better name after I ask them. You'll okay.
All right.
All right. What's your go-to order at the Waffle House?
Oh man, I just went vegan, so my Waffle House days are kind of behind me. But I remember fondly cheese and eggs with raisin toast and apple butter.
How hard is it to be a vegan on the road, dude?
It's fucking hard. It's really hard because you don't want to be a prick about it.
Right.
So it's just like vegan-ish.
Do you stop at Trader Joe's on the road and just like...
I mean, I'll stop. I mean, Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, you can get fucking vegan food at Kroger, you know, or Publix or whatever. I'll go to the cheapest supermarket that I can and buy a big bag of vegetables and, you know, fruits and vegetables and a big bag of nuts and, you know, do the best I can basically, you know, throughout the day. But yeah, I hate all the bougie affectation that goes with being vegan. You can be vegan for very cheap.
I concur. What is your favorite place to eat here in Atlanta?
Oh man, I hate to go with a chain, but I'm gonna say Flying Biscuit.
I thought you were gonna say like Bennigan's.
God, Bennigan's. So that's a deep cut.
So I interviewed Delia, who is the founder of the Flying Biscuit.
Oh, wow.
And now Delia Sausage Stand, and she's fucking hoot. So I don't know if you listen to podcasts much, but it's a good one to check out.
Oh, I'll totally check it out.
She's rad.
That's awesome.
Like one of the coolest ladies like I've ever met.
My girlfriend will freak out about that. She's the one who turned me on to Flying Biscuit.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Will she listen to it if I send you the link?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you listen to podcasts?
Infrequently. Like when I'm on the road, sometimes I'll listen to audiobooks or podcasts. I'm not like a big podcast animal. People are like, what do you listen to when you run? I listen to the thoughts bouncing off the inside of my skull.
Right.
You know, I try to go out there with, you know, I try and leave my phone at home and just go run, you know, and just think about shit. And then a lot of times when I'm at home, either I'm listening to music or I'm not listening to anything, you know, when I'm sort of cleaning or writing or whatever, doing my shit. But every once in a while, I'll tune into, you know, Rich Roll or Stanhope or, something like that.
Stand Up as a podcast now? I mean, I'm not surprised everybody does.
Oh, but dude, it's genius. Look up Stanhope's, Orgy Dome podcast.
That's the name of it?
No, that was one episode about Burning Man. But yeah, his podcast is fucking amazing.
Right.
I mean, it's spotty. I mean, some episodes are better than others. But, you know, he's had a couple where he has a former prison guard and a former inmate from the same prison. And they're he's sort of like quizzing them about like, okay, how do you make prison wine? How, you know, and like, how do you catch the guys making prison wine? What's the thing you did to fuck with the guards? What's the thing you did to fuck with the inmates? It's crazy. Yeah,
he's always been like ahead of his time, that guy.
Yes.
But I haven't kept up lately. Like I can't watch I can't watch almost any comedy because it's garbage.
Yeah.
Like Dave Chappelle's a new special, awesome. I'm all over it. But like a lot of guys, like I'll watch the 30-second preview on Netflix and I'm like, this guy doesn't seem funny at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't watch a lot of comedy either, but I mean, I see a ton of it when I'm on the road. I see it in its natural environment.
Right.
You know?
Which is more pleasurable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I discovered Stanhope when it was just sort of like Kings of Comedy and like the blue collar comedy tour, right, and shit, right, like that on Comedy Central, where, you know, when comedy was, you know, getting all like family friendly, and God, Stanhope was just a light in that sea of darkness.
Oh, dude. So yeah. So I started comedy in '96 and I moved to L.A. in '99, and some chick comic like knew him and was like, let's go to Stanhope's apartment. I was like, oh my god, like I get to hang out with Stanhope. And so
how did that go?
You know,
because he can be pretty fucking salty.
I think we had a good time. I think we just shot the shit. We actually talked about sobriety because he's like kind of anti-AA, if I recall.
Oh yeah.
And but his mom is sober, or his mom's an Al-Anon or something. I mean, I know she's dead now, but
yeah.
So that kind of came up, and I forget, wasn't because I was trying to force it on him, but I think we had like an intelligent discourse about 12-step stuff.
Yeah, he's pretty against it, but he had Dr. Drew Pinsky write the fucking foreword to his new book.
Well, there you go.
So I mean, you know, he is a you know, he's anti-establishment in every sense of the word. You know, I mean, he like the most rebellious thing that he could do was to get Dr. Drew to fucking write the foreword to his book. So that's what he did.
Right.
You know? No, the guy's a genius.
All right. So rank these in importance to you. Okay.
Okay.
Braves, Falcons, United, Hawks.
Those are just words. Those are all just words.
They're sports teams of our city.
I... The only way I could rank them is like which of those words would get me the most points playing Scrabble.
Okay.
I'm so not a sports guy. Right. I was heartbroken about the Super Bowl last year because after that, you know, the highway collapse, I was like, Atlanta could use a leg up.
Right. That's right over here.
Yeah. But I do not give a shit about sports at all.
Okay.
I couldn't be more adamantly apathetic about sports.
Totally fine. Well, here's a question you may be able to answer then. And you've only been here not that long of a time, so I don't know. But have you been to the festivals here? Do you have a favorite Atlanta festival? Nope. Okay. It's fine.
Sorry.
And how about best concert you've seen here? Is there a particular music concert you've seen here?
Well, there are two places that I have to shout out. I have to shout out the Earl, which is just one of my favorite live venues in the country, if not the world.
Okay.
I've slept there before.
Okay.
You know, and I've seen a million great shows there, some of which were even mine. Okay. I played there with Stanhope, you know, years ago. You know, I will always have a special place in my heart for the Earl. And the other thing is Rodney's open mic Monday night at Star Bar, which is just every comic, every comedy fan around the country knows about that room.
I got to get him on the show.
Oh, dude, Rodney is, yeah, he's a fucking killer. As soon as I met him, I was like, this is the guy in Atlanta.
Yeah, I left before all that, right?
Uh-huh.
There were two clubs here when I lived here, right? This was at post-boom, right? There was 20 clubs all over the suburbs. Then when I lived here, there was the Punchline, and yep. there was Uptown Comedy Corner. There wasn't Laughing Skull. There wasn't anything.
Yep.
And then while I was gone, all that developed. But yeah, I got to get him on the show.
Yeah, yeah. No, Rodney's a killer. And that room is just, he's cultivated so many promising young comics, and the crowd is amazing. They're there to shut up and laugh, you know, and that's so rare. People behave.
Well, and it's a Monday night.
Yeah, and it's packed every single night. It's awesome.
All right, let's do some tunes, man. Go get your guitar.
Awesome.
God damn it. Take two. You were the load in the sleepy sound engineer. You were the green room carpet, the stale smell of beer. You were the lingering presence as the sun died in the room. You were the drink tickets. You were the food. The regulars scowling at the band. You were the laughing bingo ladies. You were the hostile doorman. You were the karaoke bros passing one ID around. You were the prettiest girl in this goddamn one muscle car town. You were the words, you were the beat, the melody, the song. Now you're everywhere, now that you're gone. You were the poorly grounded microphone, shock in my mouth. You were the crowd getting restless as the show headed south. You were the shithead talking trash from the bathroom line while I was tearing my fucking heart out in 3-4 times. were the words, you were the beat, the melody, the song. Now you're everything, now that you're gone. You were the ashtray in a non-smoking room. You were late checkout in the early afternoon. You were something I've been chasing my whole wretched life. Something that won't let go of me no matter how hard I try. You were the words, you were the beat, the melody, the song, yeah. You were the words, you were the beat, the melody, the song. Now you're everywhere, now that you're gone. Now you're everything, now that you're gone. You're everything, everywhere. Now that you're gone.
Hey folks, there you have it, my chat with Mishka. What a great guy, what a great voice. I really enjoyed our time together. I hope I can see him again. I'll definitely check out a live show. You guys know me, I'm not a night owl. I don't do much in the evening. Oh, I did go to Brawl for a Cause. That was awesome. And I'm 97% sure that's going to be your Thursday episode. If you didn't catch the stories, it was a lot of fun. There's still a couple of posts from it. Somebody's talking and walking loud down the street. You can't hear them yet. But Brawl for Cause is coming later this week. But anyway, I will support Mishka at his show sometime soon. Please drop me a note at mattbdavis@icloud.com or go to our Instagram page and tell us how much you love us there. Instagram is ATL Podcast. Not to be confused with the other Atlanta podcast, which is Not Me, and I think you can pretty much tell pretty quickly which one's Not Me. All right. Love you, Mr. Mean It. I gotta run.